Welcome to Ufahamo Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, one of your hosts, and I'm joined by my co-host, the lovely Rachel Beatty Riedel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Kim. Happy New Year to you and to all of our listeners. We're glad to be back with you in this season, and particularly to continue our ongoing conversation coming out of the African Studies Association panel that Kim and I participated in around democratic threats, democratic backsliding, and importantly, strategies of democratic resistance. So this week, you'll have a chance to listen to our esteemed colleague, Dominika Kotter at Colgate University, talking about Benin and the ways in which democratic backsliding has happened there, serious democratic erosion, and also what strategies and sources of resilience have been in play.
Right. And we just have a few things to share with you in the news wrap today. We're going to talk about South Africa making charges against Israel on genocide at the International Court of Justice. We're going to talk about what is going on in the Red Sea, and then we'll lighten the load and talk a little bit about music. So let me start with South Africa taking Israel to court. So in hearings at the International Court of Justice, South Africa has accused Israel of carrying out a genocide in Gaza and demanded that the UN's top court order an emergency suspension of Israel's military campaign in Gaza. Now, Israel's offensive followed the October 7th attack by Hamas, and this offensive has destroyed much of Gaza and has killed more than 23,000 people, about half of whom are estimated to be children. And I want to just say on these Gaza casualty numbers, we have a great piece in Good Authority, which goes into how those numbers are even constructed and how, in fact, they're lower estimates. They're very conservative. And the actual number of casualties is likely much higher in Gaza. But Rachel, I don't know if you know this, but the way they count casualty data in the Palestinian territories is that if you are a male between the age of 18 and 50, you're not considered a casualty because you're considered a militant, a combatant. And so it's like this, it's this. So all of these numbers are according to, you know, political scientists who study things like casualty data, all of these are actually undercounts of the numbers of casualties in Gaza. So I just want to put those in perspective. Again, the Gaza Ministry of Health is estimating that more than 23,000 dead and roughly half of them children. Now, there is an essay at Africa as a Country by Sohaila Serge Paul and Justin Winchester, which gives an excellent and thorough overview of South Africa's application to the International Court of Justice and the case that their legal team is arguing. Importantly, this essay gives, you know, a full explainer on the genocide convention. You know, what are the requirements for something to be considered genocide? You know, and I think this is important because the language we use and the requirements that we have for something as severe as genocide to be happening, I think it's important that we have some fidelity to that. So please read their essay to get a clear understanding of what the genocide convention requires for something to be considered a genocide and the compelling case that the South African legal team has put together, demonstrating not just what has happened since October 7th of 2023, but actually the patterns of violence that have been happening in Gaza even prior to the Hamas attack. According to what Serge Paul and Winchester write in their essay, there is a hearing scheduled for January 11th and 12th, but the outcome of that hearing is not really going to be a definitive finding on whether or not Israel has violated the Genocide Convention, but it is going to continue moving this case forward and I think pushing a global debate about how, you know, what we should be doing to prevent further loss of life in Gaza.
Such an interesting and helpful set of resources for us to take a look at, Kim, and also really raises, I think, something that we've talked about on this podcast previously with Umar Ba around what are the roles of international bodies of justice, like the International Criminal Court, International Court of Justice in this case, and how which parties can bring charges to that body against whom. So I think that's a really
interesting. No, I remember when we interviewed Omar Ba for the podcast, it was only through that interview that I learned the kind of long history that African countries have with fighting on behalf of others, right? So, you know, the Gambia bringing, you know, charges of genocide against Myanmar for what is happening to Rohingya peoples, right? You know, that African countries have a long history of making a case for the safety of other humans, even if, you know, they're not in their own country, right? And fighting on the side of justice. And yeah, there's something, I don't know what it is. There's something recently that I've just really been enamored with courts and the things that courts can do. I mean, I've been so anti-lawyer most of my life that I think I've been, you know, I don't know, I like blocked it out of my mind, but you know, having that interview with Omar Ba a few years ago and then seeing what South Africa is doing on behalf of Palestinians. But also, you know, in my own work, you know, seeing the way, right, you know, talking about Dominika's talk today about Benin, you know, what resists democratic backsliding better than an independent court, right? So there's something about courts that I think can be really powerful for forces of good.
Exactly. And for those listeners who want to hear Kim talking about this in Malawi, tune into our episode just a few weeks ago, because the role of courts in Malawi has been really significant. And so we've seen that, you know, across such a number of countries on the domestic level. And then here we're layering in, thinking about it at the transnational, the international level. And it's really fascinating. So speaking of courts, I wanted to also bring our listeners up to date on the role of courts in Senegal here. Maybe not such a happy story, but certainly one in which courts are being looked to as the arbiters of candidacy eligibility in the upcoming February presidential elections. So as Kim and I have been discussing, and our non-residential fellow from last year, Bamba Ndiaye, has filled us in on the way in which opposition candidate Ousmane Sonko in Senegal has been put in jail on charges of corrupting the youth. So in December last month, December 2023, Ousmane Sonko had a kind of good news ruling from the courts in Dakar, the court of first instance, which ordered that Sonko could be reinstated on the electoral register. So that seemed like a ruling that could pave the way for him to be on the ballot in February in the presidential election. But just this last week, in January now of 2024, Sonko's candidacy faced two further setbacks from two different courts. So first of all, the Senegalese Supreme Court dismissed his appeal of that original ruling against his libel conviction and upheld the defamation ruling. And secondly, the Constitutional Court rejected his presidential candidate application. So here in Senegal, and in different countries, different bodies do this, but in Senegal, it's the Constitutional Court who is ruling on his candidate application to be a candidate in the presidential elections. And the court ruled that his file was incomplete because it lacked a certificate from a CDC deposit. And so they ruled that his candidacy was ineligible due to these technical or logistical elements of his application, which of course the opposition then finds a questionable and is crying out for malfeasance. So here again, the role of courts that we look to as arbiters of democracy around who can participate, under what circumstances, and to rule in many cases around the world about particular candidates and parties, their eligibility. You know, there are such interesting questions about which types of parties are or are not eligible based on founding constitutions and charters. You know, are extremist parties of any kind, like Germany had a history, of course, of not allowing extremist right-wing, you know, kind of Nazi-affiliated parties. And yet those have been relaxed over time. Now we see the right-wing party, the AfD in Germany, is, you know, the third place contender. So there are really interesting questions, I think, about the ways in which eligibility and courts and candidacy play out in protecting democracy and also potentially limiting it.
Indeed, and it's hard to know, right? Like I said, courts can be a force for good, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that everything that's happening in the courts is necessarily good for democracy, or good for, you know, people's livelihoods more generally. So now let's shift gears to, I guess the north of Africa. I don't really know how we would talk about this because it's really all around the continent, right? So we're really talking about the seas. So as I'm sure anyone who's been paying attention to the news knows, the Houthi rebels in Yemen have been firing on commercial shipping containers in the Red Sea, and this has been happening since the kind of an uptick according to ACLED's data set. There's been an uptick since October 19th. ACLED has recorded 50 violent events in the Red Sea, and they're mostly attacks involving Houthi forces and international shipping vessels. And they show, because they have this historical data, ACLED does, they show that this is a pretty big escalation, because a fifth of the 250 events that ACLED has recorded in the Red Sea since 2015 have just been these ones that have been happening since October. Now, we had a piece published on this in Good Authority by Bruce Jones at the Brookings Institute, where he kind of opens with talking about the Red Sea and how, you know, the Suez Canal at the northern end of the sea is a vital artery of trade between Asia and Europe. And nearly 30% of the world's container ships and 12% of global oil and gas supplies flow through the Suez Canal. And Rachel, I know when we were talking about this earlier, you were reminding me of that beautiful meme, that one ship that got stuck, right? And like what happens. And I mean, not that we want shipping containers to be stuck in a canal somewhere, but that was peak internet when that happened. And, you know, and of course, this is not the same. This is like, this is actual violence. And, you know, importantly, there's going to be a serious disruption to the global economy, if this continues to go on. And I think Bruce's post is really great for not just talking about the Red Sea, but putting it in the global perspective, right, of what's happening. Already, we know the cost of international shipping has spiked by 173%. And there's also going to be longer shipping times, because now major carriers have to reroute. So if they can't go through the Suez Canal, they've got to go south of Africa, right? So they've got to go around the Cape of Good Hope. And so, you know, we all remember what it was like, you know, in the early period of COVID, when there were these serious supply chain issues. If we continue to see this violence happening in the Red Sea, but also these kind of disturbances in other seas around the world, we're going to have some serious challenges with supply chain issues. And likely this is not going to help the challenge, I think, that the global, that various people around the world are experiencing regarding inflation.
Absolutely, Kim. It's so interesting when we think about how interconnected we all are, but the ways in which these, you know, historic and contemporary routes by land and by sea literally shape patterns of trade, of the movement of people, of ideas, of goods. You know, it really is so fascinating when we think about it in the big picture. So I just want to give a quick shout out to my colleague at Cornell, a historian, Eric Tagliacozzo, who's just published a new book from Princeton University Press in 2023 called In Asian Waters. And so it's really relevant here, because it talks about, it's this kind of historically sweeping account of how the sea routes of Asia have transformed a vast expanse of the globe, certainly including interactions across the continent over the past 500, and have really powerfully shaped what we know as our contemporary modern world and you know, supply chains and resource extraction and migration and all the like. And so when I think about historical and contemporary routes, that continue today, I immediately think, you know, for me, of the Trans-Saharan trade and the way in which, you know, from Mansa Musa and the gold caravans to our really contemporary movement of people and the contestation that we see across the Sahara right now, in northern Mali, across northern Nigeria, Niger, etc., is related to control often over these continuing trade routes. And we know that there are, you know, narcotics that come from Latin America through Africa, north to Europe. There's the trafficking of people. And so with this in light, interestingly, I saw a headline this week that jumped out at me, which was that the military ruling government in Niger repealed a law that criminalized human trafficking. So I thought, oh, this is an interesting headline. You know, let's dig into this a little bit further. What is happening? So from the headline, you think, well, criminalizing human trafficking, that sounds good. But interestingly, when I was looking into it a little bit more, the law itself was implemented in 2015 under pressure by the European Union in exchange for a lot of investment into Niger from the European Union at the height of what was then considered the European Union's or Europe's refugee crisis, right? Like the level of people coming into Europe was considered unacceptably high. And Kim, this relates to something that you and I have been discussing on prior podcasts about kind of the externalization of borders, the way in which Europe is pushing, and the United States and other countries are pushing, the kind of management of borders into other countries, be it in across North Africa, as Alex Blackman talked about in her discussion of Tunisia, and here in Niger. And so the law that was put in place in 2015 to restrict human trafficking was a way to jail migrants and asylum seekers, really. And so this last week, Niger's military government abrogated that controversial law. And it's in some senses seen as a human rights victory for those who had been pushing for, who had been criticizing that law in terms of trying to make safer the transportation of migrants who are seeking asylum and refuge. So I think it's just layering onto that discussion about what are the best practices in this transnational world that we live in that can uphold the security and well-being of individuals and human rights, and particularly when we think about the increasing needs for mobility.
I love this for so many reasons, because like you're sharing with us something that it's in the news, but it's nuanced, right? And for all those people who are like pro-democracy, a military junta came up with this, right? So like a military junta is like, hey, by the way, we don't like this old like neo-colonial law that the Europeans came up with. It's not that they're pro-human trafficking, right? The military junta is not pro-human trafficking, right? But they're doing something and they're taking a stand for their people, right? So I know it's hard. I know it's hard for all the democracy heads to be like, no, it's a military junta. It's a military junta that's, yeah. So you have to interpret this carefully. And right, Rachel, as you're pointing out, we have to understand the broader context in which this is happening. And I think we can do that with, you know, what we learned from, for example, the conversations we had, right? The mashup episodes that we had on migrations with Eleanor Painter, right? From last season. Likewise, reading the excellent book by Sally Hayden, My Fourth Time We Drowned, right? Kind of talking about what, not so much African migrants, but what Europe is doing to keep migrants, especially and including African migrants, out of the European continent, right? So that, and likewise, Lamas Abdelati has has a book as well that's kind of looking at these flows and the ways countries kind of decide whether to discriminate against the migrants coming in or whether they delegate dealing with migrants to, you know, UNHCR or some other, you know, refugee or migrant association, right? And I bring up Lamas Abdelati because next week we'll be featuring on Good Authority a playlist that she's put together of songs that she plays in her class on the international politics of migration and refugees. And so I hope people listen to that because, you know, this week I actually posted a playlist of songs and music videos that I play when I teach African politics. We'll have links to that in the show notes. And we'll also have a link to one that, you know, I posted about this to Blue Sky, which is the new social media thing that I'm trying out because I hate Twitter these days. But and there is a political scientist, Yvonne Guichawa, who is a professor of African politics at the Brussels School of International Studies. He shared his playlist on, in reply to me on Blue Sky, and it is awesome. And it reflects his kind of Sahelian experiences. So I fully admit that my playlist like is like Anglophone, like overrepresented. So I loved his is a Spotify playlist, and it definitely has like much more, for example, Tanari Wen than mine does. So, you know, if you're looking for something to listen to beyond the podcast today, check out some of these music playlists. And for those of you who are instructors, whether that's college professors or high school instructors looking for music to play in your classes, check it out and enjoy.
Kim, thanks so much for sharing that with us. And I can't wait to listen to all of these playlists and to share them with my students. And so now to our listeners, take a listen to this conversation with Dominika Kocher.
So I'm going to talk about the case of Benin, and I think it's a really instructive case because in a relatively short period of time, Benin went from a democratic star to a democratic backslider. So I think it really raises an important question, how and why did it happen? So most of what I will be talking about is not so much about resilience and resistance, because less of it happened. It's more the absence of it, although there have been some hopeful signs just this year. So I'll try to end on a slightly more positive note. Thinking about how and why this happened, most of the decline happened under the current president, Patrice Talon, since 2016. And I will argue that it's really key to look at the reforms that he implemented, reforms within the legal realm, electoral reforms, as well as media reforms that have the greatest impact on democratic erosion. So let me just say a few words about democracy in Benin. Benin was really touted as this democratic success story. It was one of the first countries to democratize as part of the third wave. It even set some templates for the continent, for example, pioneering the National Conference of Active Forces, which then was replicated in a number of countries. The Marxist dictator, Mathieu Kérékou, lost a multi-party election and stepped down, setting an important precedent. And then we had over a quarter century of democratic stability. There was a lot of alternation, multiple instances of presidents either losing and stepping down or respecting term limits. And so there were a lot of really good signs of democracy in Benin. And then it really began to erode after 2016. In 2021, the Freedom House labeled Benin as the country with the steepest democratic decline. And whatever index you use, you can see that decline, whether you look at the Freedom House, where the rating drops from 82 to 59 in 5 years' time, or whether you look at the VDEM, electoral democracy, or liberal democracy. This is what you can see visually here. You can see this long stretch of democratic stability and then the erosion that happens after 2016. And there are also other tangible features of this democratic decline that, for example, the 2019 legislative elections were deemed neither free nor fair. The turnout plummeted. It went down from 23% to 66% in the previous election. The same can be said about the 2021 presidential election that was described by some as electoral parody and also had a low turnout. There is also palpable decline in citizen perceptions of democracy as measured by the Afrobarometer. So this is actually quite comprehensive, and not this decline is not being disputed. So how did it happen? There were some key reforms, in particular electoral reforms, as well as the politicization of courts, which allowed to use courts to harass opposition. I would suggest that both the combination of these electoral reforms and the politicization of courts has weakened political competition. In addition, new laws also weakened freedom of expression, therefore undermining media's role as a watchdog. And I think the most influential actors in this process have been the courts, who have been the instigators of the democratic decline, and the opposition and the media, who I would suggest have suffered the most from these developments. So a few things about the institutional reform. There have been some judicial changes, and in particular, a new court was created, Court for the Repression of Economic and Terrorism Infractions, which had this very specific purpose to pursue corruption and terrorism, but it has been used to pursue the president's political opponents, and most notably Rekia Madugu, who remains in prison to this day. She has been charged of terrorism through this new court. There was also a new digital law that has been used to prosecute multiple journalists. And in addition to this, electoral reforms, including new party charter and so-called sponsorship reform, that really collectively increased barriers to entry for the opposition. It increased the number, this is a series of reforms, they increased the number of quote-unquote sponsors that are required for parties to be able to compete in elections. There has been an increase in the number of founding members required to start a political party. And that actually makes it very difficult to register a party or to be able to contest elections. There has been also an increase in filing fees, so it makes contestation expensive to political actors. And if parties fail to win 10% of the vote, they lose their deposit. Now, let me say a few things about the courts. In addition to creation of new courts, there has been also loss of independence and politicization. And for example, President Talon appointed his personal lawyer and friend as the president of the Constitutional Court. And what followed is a series of rulings that have been made against opposition and have been quite controversial. As I mentioned, the courts have been used, they have been complicit in persecution of opponents, apart from Rekia Madugu, that I already mentioned, also Lionel Zinsou, Sébastien Ajavan. These were the second and third biggest vote getters in the last in the 2016 presidential election. So potentially biggest challengers to President Talon. Also courts have been involved in enforcement of laws that targeted journalists. Now, there is a glimmer of hope because courts have played a slightly more positive role in the lead up to the January 2023 election. And interestingly, this happened as soon as the president of the Constitutional Court, who, as I mentioned, was a personal friend of President Talon, stepped down to pursue political career. And there has been a fairly swift change in the nature of rulings of the court. So it's really quite clear that the personnel changes were quite significant in this case. Now, this all had a profound impact on the media. I would describe media as mostly a victim of the changes in Benin. We have seen a visible decline in press freedom. Since 2016, Benin has fallen 43 places in an index conducted by Reporters Without Borders. Its absolute score also fell quite dramatically. The problem with Beninese media is that they are financially dependent and they have very limited resources. So they are quite vulnerable to capture or harassment by the government. As I mentioned, the new digital law has been used to prosecute journalists. Basically, what that law did is that it applied very low barriers to accuse a journalist of libel or you know, hate speech, and that really leads also journalists to self censor. The High Authority for Broadcasting and Communication has also used its power, that you know, power to grant licenses to media outlets, to basically shut many of them down. So La Nouvelle Tribune and SICA have been forced to seek operations at different times because their licenses were not renewed. And I think I missed a slide here. This also had, the reforms that happened had profound effect on opposition. Opposition has been really severely weakened under President Talon through these electoral reforms. There were three elections, so one set of legislative, local, and presidential elections with almost no opposition participation. And that did not change until the last parliamentary elections in January of this year, where the opposition actually managed to win, you know, 28 seats out of 109 in Beninese parliament. So they're still in a very small minority, but this is a sign of progress of sorts. To try to end on this more optimistic note, you know, has democratic erosion stopped? I think it is too early to say. I think it has perhaps plateaued. It's not this year, over the last 12 months, it has not gotten worse. But the reversal of backsliding, so the improvement has been very, very slight. So I don't think that we can talk about a reversal, but more that perhaps a pause in further decline. The legislative elections of this year were a positive sign because they were freer and we noted fewer irregularities. There were some important decisions by the Constitutional Court after the leadership change that allowed opposition to participate. And that was really crucial to making the changes in outcome that resulted in the return of opposition to parliament. Just over the last couple of weeks, There has been release of some detainees. But again, it's it's a small step forward, but perhaps not enough, because several political prisoners remain in Benin to this day. So this is a very qualified note of optimism.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamwe Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamweafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tomoklo. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.